This is Community Voices on 91.9 UIS featuring an event you may have missed, America's Place in the World, Foreign Policy in a Second Trump Administration. This forum is a partnership between NPR Illinois, the UIS Center for State Policy and Leadership, and the UIS School of Politics and International Affairs. Here's the Center for State Policy and Leadership Executive Director, Molly Lamb.
Welcome to our webinar this afternoon, America's Place in the World, Foreign Policy in a Second Trump Term. I'm the Executive Director for the Center for State Policy and Leadership, and we're really ecstatic to be able to be here on this webinar in sponsorship and partnership with the School of Politics and International Affairs for this hour-long discussion around American politics and elections, and specifically foreign policies. I am going to turn it over to my colleague, Sean Crawford, who's a managing editor with NPR Illinois, and he's going to get us started for the discussion.
Certainly, a lot of people are paying attention to foreign policy right now with the U.S. and Israel, the attack on Iran. Many are wondering what's next for the Middle East and the rest of the world. So we have a panel of experts today to talk about that and other topics related to foreign policy. We have on our panel Dr. Adriana Crocker, professor at the UIS School of Politics and International Affairs. Also, Dr. Ali Nizamuddin, who's a professor also with the UIS School of Politics and International Affairs. And also in the school, we have Dr. Brandon Bolte, an assistant professor, and Dr. Isabel Skinner, also an assistant professor. So thanks to all of you for being with us. We may not get to everything we want to talk about this hour. The world is a big place, of course, but we will start by hearing from each panelist. They're going to give you some opening thoughts, and that will launch our conversation. So let's get started. Brandon, we're going to go to you first, and thanks for being on the panel today.
In the news, it does seem like international violence is becoming a lot more common. Countries are using military force in ways that we haven't really seen in a long time. And really just in the past year, the United States has engaged in direct conventional military force, a variety of different targets and countries. I've tallied up all of the number of international armed conflicts in the world since the end of World War II in each year. And also those in which the U.S. was a direct military combatant. These are based only on conflicts that are international, those that are between states. Internal wars that don't have any international intervention are excluded from this. It's also kind of a conservative estimate because I'm requiring some kind of threshold for an amount of people that need to be affected. The trends are kind of interesting. After 1975, the United States doesn't really use a whole lot of direct military force very often, at least to against other countries. This maintained itself for a long, long time, with the exception of a few big wars. During that part of the Cold War, the United States did sponsor proxy forces. They instigated coups d'etat to oust the leaders of governments that were aligned with the Soviet Union, or otherwise propped up regimes that were often non-democratic, but at least not communist. And this led to indirect involvement via sponsorship of conflicts all over the world, right? So the U.S. propped up regimes like Mobutu in Zaire, the Shah in Iran, Pinochet in Chile, and the Somozas in Nicaragua, among others. The U.S. rarely used direct military force with boots on the ground that led to more than a few kind of battle deaths over this period of time. There was an invasion in Grenada in 1983, and then a conflict in Lebanon in 83 and 84. And then in 1989, the U.S. invaded Panama and ousted the leader there. All of these were relatively brief military episodes, and only Grenada was clearly and explicitly linked to broader Cold War geopolitics. But when the Soviet Union collapsed, the United States entered this period of hegemony, what scholars sometimes call the unipolar moment. The United States would be the greatest unrivaled military power in the world, which also meant that its use of military force or its restraint, as well as its influence and increasingly globalized and interconnected trade regime, shaped in part by U.S.-supported international institutions, would be enormously consequential whenever it chose to wield that power. U.S. administrations no longer needed to worry about containing another great power's influence in the world. The goal was to preserve American power. armed conflicts in the world proportionally became more localized. Civil wars became more prominent than ever before, relatively speaking. The US didn't use tons and tons of military force to intervene in these conflicts, specifically with boots on the ground, and especially after the infamous Black Hawk Down moment in Somalia in the 1990s. The appetite for getting involved abroad decreased, especially in the developing world. When the US did use military force in the 1990s, it was multilateral. The Gulf War was fought alongside dozens of allied militaries. Kosovo in 1999 was a NATO operation. American diplomacy, though, reached a new level of influence. Clinton emphasized conflict mediation using American soft power to help reach the Good Friday Agreement between the UK and Ireland, the Oslo Accords, and a few others. After 9/11, things took a dramatic turn. The US invaded Afghanistan, helping to oust the Taliban government and eventually Iraq, leading to the ousting of Saddam Hussein. And the US military became involved in other conflicts as well, with Bush seeking to use military force to counteract a rising global terrorism threat. US military interventionism under Obama increased in his second term, even more so in Trump's first term, and then it dropped from 11 conflicts to 5 under Biden. American military intervention rose and fell with broader trends in international conflict, but proportionally to the number of international conflicts in the world, the US's involvement, direct military involvement, still remained relatively low by this metric. Almost all of it was involvement in conflicts related to fighting ISIS, Al-Qaeda, or their affiliates or other non-state actors. What seems to be changing in Trump's second term is a willingness to use offensive military force as a tool of statecraft in ways that we haven't really seen in decades. Not being used as a tool of last resort. It's being used also more against regimes, not just non-state actors. And Trump has even been willing to threaten military force against allies. I still believe that the United States remains a global hegemon, but Trump is wielding hard power in ways that the US hasn't seen it, even in this unipolar period, in ways that I think could have long-lasting, potentially damaging consequences for global armed conflict, but also in ways that might appear to create short-term gains, but that could be detrimental in the long run to America's standing if other global powers are on the rise and if, as some scholars believe, if we're starting to enter this multipolar period with other great powers becoming much more relatively powerful compared to the US.
Thanks, Brandon. Appreciate that. And let's move on. Adriana Crocker, let's hear from you.
I'm going to take a similar approach to Dr. Bolte, but I'm going to focus on Latin America, which is what I specialize in. And I'm going to be looking at what has changed in this administration and what hasn't changed. Historian G. Pope Atkins wrote in his book, Latin America and the International Political System, that throughout history, the US has followed a policy of strategic denial in the Western Hemisphere. Strategic denial means preventing outside actors from establishing political, military, or economic footholds in Latin America. This has been viewed as essential to US national security, but also involves economic and commercial interests. In the 19th century, this approach was embodied in the Monroe Doctrine, which asserted that European powers would no longer colonize or interfere in the affairs of the American nations. The policy, interestingly enough, was unilateral. Latin America was not involved in putting together this policy, and it was also temporal. So when the alleged threat subsided, so was the policy. Sometimes it was not even used. For example, when France invaded Mexico in the mid-1800s, the US did not intervene. Also, what has characterized US-Latin American relations is this US perception of Latin America in paternalistic and stereotyping manner. In cartoons published during the 19th century, Latin Americans were seen as children and depicted as immature or weak population that needed Uncle Sam's help. Important also during the early 20th century were the policies of intervention for geopolitical and economic reasons. It was called the Big Stick Policy under Teddy Roosevelt. Woodrow Wilson dollar diplomacy spearheaded these policies, and interventions were almost constant during the early 20th century, particularly in the Caribbean Sea and Central America, Nicaragua, and Cuba, more particularly. With some instances where soft power was used during the Cold War era, with JFK and his Alliance for Progress, the Cold War was also marked by similar trends, yet direct interventions or explicit show of force were very rare. The rival this time was the Soviet Union, the US support of anti-communist and very repressive dictatorial regimes were evident throughout the Cold War, not only in Central America and the Caribbean, but also in South America, more particularly the case of Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Chile. The post-Cold War period was a period of optimism, democratization, and U.S. policy of what they call benign neglect. Foreign Affairs actually describes these three decades as a period in which Latin America was largely an afterthought in U.S. foreign policy. Indeed, the U.S. generally supported the region's democratization. It was not involved in the region's major policy developments, like increasing minority rights, adoption of quotas or parity laws for women. This was due primarily to inter-American cooperation, but excluding the U.S., and through what I call normative diffusion in my research. This policy of benign neglect has changed with the current administration as a more aggressive foreign policy in the region has risen. Regarding the Western Hemisphere, the U.S. National Security Strategy, which was unveiled late last year, announced a pledge to reassert and enforce American preeminence in the Western Hemisphere and deny strategic vital assets to rival powers, particularly in this case, China. It is a Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. According to this policy, the U.S. has a right to increase its military presence in the region, advance naval forces to control migrant routes and illicit trafficking, and carry out deployment at borders. It is the big stick policy of the 21st century and entails coercion instead of negotiation through tariff wars and cutting development aid, providing support to like-minded governments like Argentina, military intervention disregarding international law, and access to natural resources. Venezuela has been a good example of these last 2 points. One of the caveats of this administration, not seen since the early Cold War years, is that currently, as Michael Kimmich writes, Trump's strategy risks militarizing problems that are not military in nature. The big elephant in the room now is China's presence in Latin America. China-Latin America relationship has been developing and expanding for more than 3 decades and remains active despite a recent slowdown. China's imports from Latin America range from extractives to agricultural goods, and Latin America has been also a vital market for Chinese goods, including textiles, vehicles, and so on. Apart from serious international law problems, U.S. foreign policy under Trump has been inconsistent and has striking omissions. When referring to the Western Hemisphere, the NSS document does only deal with Latin America without mentioning Canada. Neither does it address ties with Mexico or Brazil, nor the collapse of Haiti. Indeed, defining policies for different regional security challenges, competing with China and coordinated responses to a diverse number of countries requires serious strategy. Yet the threat of the use of force or the use of force instead of a sophisticated policy have become commonplace during this era. Finally, Latin America has been caught again in a global rivalry, this time between the US and China. Faced with a choice between the two powers, governments and voters may adopt pragmatic positions. Candidates favorable to Trump may reach agreements on natural resources with the U.S., but still try to pursue economic relations with China. Another, with Europe, there is this big Mercosur-EU agreement that nobody's been talking about, that is, could be the largest trade bloc in the world. Rising right-wing pro-Trump governments in Latin America has been notable. For example, just a few weeks ago, the Trump administration unveiled the Shield of Americas and pledged to expand security coordination in the region. The program, though, is lacking details. Additionally, this may divide the region further because although the organizers of the summit claim that it seeks to strengthen ties between the U.S. and the rest of the countries in the region, there were only 13 pro-Trump leaders invited, and powerful countries such as Mexico, Colombia, Peru, and Brazil were not in attendance. So apart from other issues, there is a possibility that much like during the Cold War, the region will be dangerously polarized again.
Thank you. Dr. Ali Nizamuddin is joining us as well, and let's hear from him.
Dr. Crocker's clairvoyant comments, I'm going to go from there because that is a good segue to the stereotypes and the intervention and the patterns that we can see between American involvement in Latin America and American involvement in the Middle East. I want the listeners to go to a specific event in Latin American politics. In 1973, there was a leader by the name of Salvador Allende, who was democratically elected in Chile. However, he nationalized the nation's copper and iron resources, thereby posing a threat to American corporations. He was overthrown violently. Many people simply disappeared, and he was replaced with Augusto Pinochet, who turned out to be a war criminal. That occurred on September 11th, 1973. I was a student on 9/11/2001. I was defending my dissertation the month afterwards. The largest newspaper had a headline that you have your September 11th and we have ours. Now, go back one generation prior to 1951, when there was a democratically elected government in Iran. His name was Mohammad Mossadegh. He was actually made Time Magazine Man of the Year, even though many leaders were alive at the time, some great leaders like Churchill and Eisenhower and Truman, De Gaulle, all of these leaders were alive. Yet, Time Magazine made him Man of the Year because of his policies, his reform policies, like land reform and rent control, Social Security, and so forth. He was violently overthrown because he nationalized the country's oil resources. The Anglo-Iranian Oil Company later became BP. He kicked out that particular corporation and nationalized the country's oil, leading to an overthrow and a coup by the CIA. And he was violently replaced by the Shah of Iran, who turned out to be a tyrant and a dictator. So the pattern of undermining democracy and replacing that democracy with a dictatorship persists to the present for political expediency. Since 1979, since the Iranian Revolution, the type of political system that we have in Iran is a strange confluence between a democracy and a theocracy. At the very bottom is the Majlis, which is the assembly, which is the parliament of Iran. And then there's also the president. Both are democratically elected for four-year terms. And above that is the Guardian Council that determines whether or not the laws that are passed by the Majlis or the assembly and the president are consistent with Islamic law. So if there's some sort of a law that they pass that is antithetical to the Islamic faith, they would reject it. For example, alcohol or pornography. Above that is a supreme leader that exercises enormous powers. And it is this supreme leader that Israel and the U.S. killed in the salvo of this conflict. Iran has always been the prize for Israel from the very beginning. And I looked up the first time that Netanyahu alarmed the world community about how dangerous Iran is. That was more than 30 years ago, that Iran is 2 weeks away from a nuclear weapon. At the behest of Israel, and at the behest of certain powerful movements in the military state, we undermined the regime that existed in 2003 in Saddam Hussein on false pretexts and pretenses that it was weapons of mass destruction. All of those lies were debunked. It is ironic that Iran had agreed to all of the terms, including zero enrichment, only to be invaded, only to be bombed. It negotiated twice, only to be bombed twice. And it is so ironic that a country that has 6,000 nuclear weapons, namely the U.S., and Israel that has 300 to 400, is commenting on whether countries can acquire nuclear weapons or not, even if it's for civilian purposes. I honestly believe, and this is just my personal opinion, that Trump did not want to go to war against Iran. He had to be cajoled and brought into this conflict at the behest of Israel and at the behest of Netanyahu. He's also influenced by powerful Zionists who are Christian. Christian Zionists and Jewish Zionists are united in this call for a greater Israel that sees the proper territory of Israel belonging between the Nile and the Euphrates. That includes all of the land in Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Iran, and Turkey. And Egypt as well. Now we are knee-deep in war in the Middle East, and Naftali Bennett, the former prime minister of Israel, has said that Turkey is the next Iran. No one had to die for this conflict, whether it be in Israel or in Iran or in the Middle East or anywhere else. American soldiers did not have to die. And definitely the 168 girls that died in that school did not have to die. Their only crime was that they went to school and never came back. And it is so heartless to hear what is being said in the White House that these are just collateral damages. When Timothy McVeigh blew up the federal building in 1995, he was told that there were kids inside that building, in the Oklahoma building. And he dismissed that as collateral damages. And that is painful to us because those are our kids. But what if they were Iranian kids? Why are we so cavalier in the dismissal of those kids? What if they were Jewish kids? Would we be so cavalier, so dismissive? the resolve that we find in Iran, the resistance that we see, is perfectly, perfectly understandable because this war was completely avoidable.
Ali Nizamuddin on how the Iran conflict has been completely avoidable. More when we come back as Sean Crawford moderates America's Place in the World, Foreign Policy in a Second Trump Term, as we hear about the impact of immigration. This is Community Voices with an event you may have missed, America's Place in the World, Foreign Policy in a Second Trump Administration. Back to moderator Sean Crawford as Dr. Skinner indicates how immigration is at its highest level in history.
We have with us Dr. Isabel Skinner, and let's hear from her.
We've covered a lot of ground already. I'm going to center more on some things that are happening right now in the present and continue the theme of consequences. I study American politics, but I study immigration and refugee issues. I want to talk about who refugees are and who people who are displaced are and what the numbers are looking like now. The UN High Commission for Refugees protects asylum seekers, refugees, internally displaced people, and stateless people, and refugees who are returning home. As of June 2025, that's the latest numbers, there was 117.3 million people who are displaced. The last few years are the most displaced people ever in history. That's one in 70 people on Earth, just to give some perspective. Most displaced people are actually internally displaced. That means they're escaping or in the midst of war and conflict or disaster, but they are unable or unwilling to cross the border to leave their country. They don't have anywhere to go. Still, there are over 42 million refugees who are people who've left their country due to war, persecution, natural disaster. The top countries of origin for refugees, it gets a little tricky because people often have to move more than once. But let's think about like conflict base where people are leaving from. Sudan was number one. Also, Afghanistan, Syria, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo were the top origin countries for 2025. The top receiving countries that are hosting refugees 2025, number one was Turkey, followed closely by Iran, Colombia, Germany, and Uganda. 70% of refugees are actually in neighboring countries, and 71% are hosted by low or middle income countries. Iran was recently upgraded to like a middle income country, for example. Since the end of the Cold War, as we've talked about, a lot of conflicts are more internal. Something else that's happening is that some of the conflicts involve non-state actors like militias and terrorist groups, or this combination of countries versus groups. As my colleagues have mentioned, overall death tolls have gone down since the 1940s, but civilians and particularly children continue to perish as quote unquote collateral damage of conflict. We see this far range remote missiles and drones targeting people and places and schools and hospitals. That creates horrible asymmetries and moral quandaries. We even have the current Trump administration talking about the potential for AI to make decisions without human beings about human life. The top causes of displacement in the world are war, but also political instability, political persecution, and natural disasters. Political persecution could include religious or identity-based attacks on groups by their government. I'm thinking like minority groups or LGBT people. This could also be ideological dissidents. Climate change is already displacing millions of people due to extreme weather, famine, drought. We see this inside of the United States and all over the world. Unfortunately, these things are not mutually exclusive, right? If you have war, that exacerbates famine. If you have famine, that can lead to war. If you have climate change, that makes everything worse. That's also why we see people in refugee camps having to move over and over and over again. These things feed into each other.
Iran is certainly in the news, as we mentioned. So let's start with that as well as we move along here. Dr. Nizamuddin, you pointed out Israel cajoling, as you said, the U.S. into this attack on Iran. I've known that Israel is a strong ally of the U.S. How much influence does it really have?
Joseph Kent, who was a director of the National Center for Counterterrorism, just recently resigned. He, in the letter, stated that American soldiers do not need to die for someone else's cause. He cited the Israeli lobby, in other words, the American Israeli Political Action Committee, as well as the pressure put upon Trump by Netanyahu. It is not accidental that Netanyahu came and visited Trump on several different occasions. The lobby is very, very powerful. However, the Christian lobby is also very powerful too. What is unique is that due to the eschatology of the Christian and Jewish Zionists, they see the apocalypse and the greater Israel belonging to the Jewish people between the Nile and the Euphrates. But I think what they don't say, which is, I think, very interesting, is that the end result in Christian eschatology for the Jewish people is really bad. They never share that. Either Jews are all killed or forcefully converted to Christianity towards the end times. But that is not something that is mentioned or discussed. With respect to whether or not this lobby was necessarily behind it, you may want to go back to a leaked document back to 1992, where seven countries were specified for preemptively attacking and replacing those regimes. Among the seven, the seventh one was Iran. And that was orchestrated by Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, Richard Perle. These became ultimately the neocons. So the design and the end goal of destabilizing that part of the world for a political purpose is something that was articulated many, many decades ago.
And Dr. Bolte, you talked about the fact that this action going on now may have long-ranging consequences, maybe not even what we're hoping for. Are we talking something of like what we saw with Afghanistan, or are we talking something else here? What do you foresee?
It's really hard to foresee what might happen because in some ways, these kinds of military incursions by the United States are not entirely unprecedented, but at the same time, the way that the policy approach that the Trump administration is taking does seem different in some ways. So, for example, when the United States became a little bit more interventionist in a more of a conventional military way under Bush, the foreign policy doctrine emphasized the willingness to use preemptive force, but also is motivated by a kind of neoconservative ideology and this stuff that Ali was talking about, being willing to overthrow regimes that were unfriendly using military force. However, at the same time, rightfully or wrongly, Colin Powell during the Gulf War and beyond also believed that if force is going to be used, there should be some efforts to get the public behind it, to use war specifically. And also, if you break it, you own it. This leads to an approach of nation building that the United States needs to, if they're going to change something using military force, it also needs to invest in rebuilding. This hasn't really been successful in cases like Afghanistan, and arguably there was quite a bit of turbulence in Iraq after that invasion. It seems like the Trump administration's approach here is still to use military force to oust unfriendly regimes or regimes that it views as unfriendly without much regard for what comes next. There's a few maybe strategic reasons behind that. If you're vague about your intentions, then you can sell whatever you want as your win. Get out when you want and say that you were successful. Come what may. It can be justified under kind of humanitarian motivations and a belief that the country, this leaves room for domestic movements to take charge and institute democracy in their country. These are challenging things to do, especially in a place like Iran that has such an entrenched regime that isn't so easily ousted for a couple of reasons. One being that all of the guns are owned by the IRCG, but also because the motivation behind the regime, like an underlying ideological core component of the identity of the regime, is anti-Americanism, in the sense that when the Iranian Revolution occurred, it was replacing a regime that was, as we've talked about before, installed basically by the United States. After then the Cold War ended and the Soviet Union fell, the supreme leader of Iran learned that opening up and reforming in that way wasn't necessarily going to be successful for the regime. And so, long story short, this is a deeply entrenched regime that isn't so easily changed even through just military force. And what I'm concerned about is that the United States doesn't have much of an end game here, that we don't really know what's going to happen, but I don't know that they really care.
And with this instability in the Middle East, I want to go back to Dr. Skinner. You were talking about refugees, people being displaced. Of course, there's Iran, but could this spread to other countries in the Middle East as well and create even a bigger humanitarian crisis?
Definitely. So we're only just a few weeks in to the war by the U.S. and Israel on Iran. And already millions of people are displaced, mostly internally displaced. But this includes reshuffling people who were already refugees, like I was saying, from regional conflicts and civil wars in Syria, for example. Already as of March 12th, the UN estimates 3.2 million people are displaced inside of Iran. 1 million people are displaced inside of Lebanon. The Lebanon example is really interesting. And then also, again, remember, Iran was one of the top host countries in the world for refugees. So all of those refugees continue to be refugees, right? And then people who had shelter have lost it. Some Iranians have tried to flee to Iraq or Turkey. Turkey is also one of the top refugee host nations in the world, but they had more of an open door policy for Syrians for a long time, and that's created a lot of issues for them and backlash. Now they're trying to clamp down on Iranian refugees and pre-existing refugees inside of Iran by trying to host people at the border in camps on a temporary basis, but definitely, especially with this neighbors theory of where people are, there's just not room to go. A lot of refugees inside of the Middle East are contained within the Middle East and are just shuffling, running out of options, running out of places to go.
Dr. Crocker, I'm not sure if you had anything you wanted to add about Iran. I also wanted to hear your thoughts on Venezuela. That's something that probably people have almost forgotten about. That was in the news so much for a few weeks. And now with all of this happening, it seems the focus has gone away from that. Feel free to elaborate on that.
I'm listening to everyone else's comments. Two things that I think this administration is different from other administrations, particularly, you know, during George W. Bush and his New York conservatism. I'm not sure this administration wants regime change, at least in Latin America. It's this idea of regime compliance, not regime change. What happened in Venezuela, Maduro was toppled. It was an authoritarian regime, but the regime is still the same. You have the vice president, you have the different interest groups still dominating Venezuela. It's just that it's more friendly towards the U.S. and the U.S. is fulfilling its commercial interests in the area. Their business trying to get in Venezuela right now, U.S. business trying to get contracts with mining and, of course, oil. At least in Latin America, the foreign policy was shaped by Marco Rubio, who is the first Latin American Secretary of State in the history of the U.S., and he's the son of a Cuban immigrant. And so he has a very subjective feelings about Latin America, particularly about regimes like Venezuela and Cuba. Some have argued, I read in the New York Times, I think it was yesterday, that foreign policy shaped by Marco Rubio, a policy of both neoconservative and transactionalism, it says, because it is using military power to turn authoritarian regimes into client states. Do not want democratization, as was the argument made by George W. Bush, you know, during the Iraq war, but they just want regime compliance. So it's very different. Essentially, it seems like it's not much about regime change, but it's all about power.
Well, let me ask about Cuba then, since you brought that up as well, and Marco Rubio with a Cuban heritage. What is the downside you see, or is there one, of the U.S. taking some type of military action to try to control Cuba?
Maybe they will, but I cannot guess. But I don't think they will take military action. I think what they want is probably push the current leader of Cuba, Díaz-Canel, to resign. But there have been talks with the grandson of Raúl Castro, Raulito. It's called Raúl Guillermo Rodríguez Castro. He could be the leader of Cuba. So once again, they're not going after regime change. They're going after the U.S. is going after regime compliance. And I think that's key, particularly in Latin America. They may, if there is not such change in leadership in Cuba, the US may resort to military action, but if there is a change in leadership, even a Castro will be leading Cuba, as long as it's a Castro that is compliant with this administration.
Dr. Skinner, I believe you wanted to weigh in.
Just wanted to add a quick statistic here for some context. As Dr. Crocker's mentioning, the regime hasn't really changed. So the interim president, Delcy Rodriguez, there's like no substantive changes. And there's a lot of crackdown still on people who were anti-Maduro, right? The UN has found that at least 87 people, including journalists and political protesters, have been detained since January. So since this started happening, this transition, and civic and press repression is like still a really serious concern in Latin America as a whole, but especially in Venezuela. And I also just wanted to point out again, one of the other top host countries for refugees is Colombia. And that's because largely of the millions of Venezuelans who are in Colombia, but then all over the place. Like, I have personally encountered Venezuelan refugees in Chicago, but also in Santiago, Chile, really far apart.
Refining the vocabulary, regime compliance seems to be the new foreign policy for the United States. We'll be back with more of an event you may have missed, America's Place in the World, Foreign Policy in a Second Trump Term. This is Community Voices with an event you may have missed, America's Place in the World, Foreign Policy in a Second Trump Term. Sean Crawford takes us back into the forum discussing Russia.
We haven't forgotten about Russia and what's been going on with Russia and Ukraine over the last several years. And I'll just open this up to anybody on the panel that wants to give us their view of how that's gone so far under the Trump administration, especially, and what may lie ahead between those countries. Brandon, go ahead.
Something that I thought was telling is that although there used to be quite a bit of attention that the Trump administration was dedicating towards some kind of resolution to that conflict, it does seem to have at least fallen by the wayside because the US is now focused on other endeavors. Something that we said about maybe the short attention span of the administration in that regard, it may be that other countries and other countries' leaders will learn from that. The Russians are benefiting from the current war in Iran. The energy crisis that is bubbling up. We've all seen increasing gas prices, and it's probably only going to get worse. These are things that are actually benefiting the Russians because the Trump administration, for example, has basically allowed Russian oil to go by some sanctions or is really kind of limiting its ability to trade energy resources. And that's been helpful to countries like India that rely on these kinds of things. But in the meantime, Russia is benefiting from revenues, oil or energy kind of revenues, which it can use to support its economy, to skirt the pain that these sanctions are supposed to be imposing on it. Meanwhile, it's fighting against the Ukrainians while the United States has turned its attention elsewhere. Broadly speaking, the diversion of attention of the United States and its resources, its military and diplomatic resources, to elsewhere in the world, I think is going to benefit Putin, at least in the short term.
Anybody else want to weigh in on that?
Ali talked a little bit about U.S. credibility, and that's something that I think is going to be really important over the next few years. Last year, an Ipsos poll found that when they polled people in 29 countries, only 46% felt that the U.S. had a positive influence on world affairs. That was last year in April 2025. I would not be surprised at all as somebody who studies public opinion in the US and other places if that were to fall again, especially after this intervention in Latin America, super unpopular, the war in Iran, super unpopular. The Trump administration has been begging our allies to come to our aid in Iran. Nobody is biting. I think this is also not surprising in terms of Europeans saying we're at war already defending Ukraine. This is not how NATO really works. Trump's expectations of like what NATO is and what some of these other institutions are is just at odds with what the other member nations feel about that relationship.
We have a president who is attacking and besmirching and belittling not rivals, but allies. He has gone after NATO, Germany, France, ridiculed them, belittled them, then burned all of these bridges and wonders why nobody's behind him. Then claims that we won the war in the first hour. If we won the war in the first hour, then why are we begging NATO allies to come and help us? This is threatening Greenland, and then Canada is a 51st state, Venezuela is a 51st state. It's a type of foreign policy that we have not seen in a long time. I can completely understand why public opinion is low in some of these countries.
Tenuous as it sometimes is with the world order, it has been held together in many cases because of the economic benefits a lot of countries have received through the years, and being allied with the U.S. is one of those, the NATO countries as well. With the tariffs that have been put on, with some of these other concerns about what it means for the economies of these, I look at Canada, for example, close allies. Is that got the real possibility of having long-lasting damage here to the world order? Or is this something that maybe down the road, if Donald Trump's not in office, this can be fixed rather quickly?
For Biden's one term, he spent a lot of his time as someone who has a lot of experience of foreign policy trying to mend these relationships. But of course, he only served one term as president. There's that. One thing that's kind of simmering under the surface here is it's not random that Venezuela and Iran are targets of intervention. The underlying theme is oil. So as Brandon mentioned, now Russia might be getting benefits because they also have a lot of oil. Canada has a lot of oil. Greenland has a lot of oil. Like, this is not random. There's a really obvious pattern to this intervention and to these machinations going on. That's something that should just bring out into the light, especially because when the administration is asked about the justifications for war, it's like a grab bag. It's like mixed messages and just different rationales. Humanitarian rationales aren't even really being used that much right now, but if they were, I think it would be pretty difficult to take it seriously when there's a lot of degradation of human rights and civil rights and democratic institutions here at home in the U.S. right now.
Is the weapon of oil that Iran is using against the world economy and against the U.S. A significant portion of natural gas and oil goes through the Strait of Hormuz that is being blocked. Much of the destination is to Asian countries. 60% of India's oil goes through the Strait of Hormuz, 40% for China. Half of the fertilizer goes through the Strait of Hormuz too, which is so important when it comes to planting season in many of these Asian countries. Prime Minister Takeuchi said that if we were to be deprived of the flow of oil from the Strait of Hormuz for 8 to 9 months, we would deplete our resources, our reserves. But not only that, over 80% of the food that GCC countries get comes from the Strait of Hormuz. And that is an important choke point that is in the news that has led to increasing oil prices and disruption in the supply chain.
Dr. Bolte.
First of all, I agree that oil and energy is the most powerful weapon that the Iranians have right now to combat this war. The Iranians, I think, are trying to play a strategy where they will be able to, I mentioned earlier that the Trump regime can basically sell whatever they want as a win. The Iranian regime, I think, victory in their case is survival. And that's not necessary. If they can outlast basically the pressures on the world economy that the war is causing, then they're going to walk away, obviously depleted militarily, but that's the image that the regime can sell. That's the fight that they're going to wage. More broadly, my fear is that this approach of foreign policy, this use of coercive force so widely as just another statecraft tool, as well as the kind of increasing tariff regime, kind of the United States pulling away from trade agreements that have been kind of mutually prosperous across the world, this kind of damage is maybe not irreparable, but as it continues to get worse, it might be, especially as if China continues to grow economically, if Russia can build up its own capabilities and we start entering into more of a multipolar world, other countries, middling powers, for example, have other options. And as the United States basically is forcing other countries to find other options rather than trade with the U.S. or rely on diplomatic relations with the U.S., In the short term, it might look like the US is getting these wins, but in the long run, we're stretching military and economic resources quite thin. And in the meantime, the trade regime is going to change. Countries are going to find other opportunities. And those kinds of trade agreements also don't just fall apart immediately. Those things will remain entrenched. They will build on each other. And so as we see kind of a changing world order, I'm not sure that this foreign policy approach is going to be beneficial to the U.S.'s standing in the world order in the long run.
Go ahead, Dr. Crocker.
One of the issues, I think, with this intervention in Iran is that it doesn't have a clear purpose. I mean, you're talking about oil. Yeah, that's what we said. He said that. But he also talks about regime change. He talks about every day it's a change of policy. So there's no clear purpose. So how are you going to say, well, we fulfill this purpose, we're ready to leave, if it doesn't have a clear purpose? And the same has happened in Latin America. What was the purpose of going into Venezuela? Getting rid of the top leader and that's it? Or have a democratic system? Not really. So it's just very muddled. Foreign policy is muddled. It's not clear. It hasn't been made clear for us what purpose these interventions have been taking place. It's very difficult to extract ourselves from them when you don't have a specific objective.
Dr. Nizamuddin, I wanted to go back to you. You mentioned China a moment ago. What happens with China, especially as they watch what's happening with the Strait of Hormuz, what else is going on with the U.S. and its foreign policy? Does China just sit back and watch and maybe wait for things to implode, or do they take some more direct actions, maybe even to try to secure more world peace?
A beautiful aphorism from Sun Tzu, the one who wrote The Art of War 2,500 years ago, comes to mind, where Sun Tzu said that never interrupt your rival in the middle of a mistake. So it seems that China is going to be the greatest beneficiary of this because China is expanding economically in a stable way. It is not trying to liberate anybody. It is not trying to liberate anybody. It is not going into these foolish wars of choice and destabilizing countries. The world economy is predicated on stability. And this is precisely what is being undermined by American hegemony. Many countries, including Middle Eastern countries, including Latin American countries, may turn to China as a bulwark and a support that they can partner with. European countries may turn to China because of the good relationships China has. Oh, by the way, parenthetically, the oil from Iran is flowing to China perfectly fine, because 90% of the oil exports to China from Iran goes to China. So they are allowing Chinese ships to go through. So that is not being interrupted strategically.
All right. Well, we'll continue to watch. There's a lot of other things we couldn't get to in our time, but hopefully we covered several topics and they were very enlightening. So let me wrap up here, and I'm going to turn it back over to Molly Lamb in just a moment. I want to thank our panel, Dr. Adriana Crocker, Dr. Ali Nizamuddin, Dr. Brandon Bolte, and Dr. Isabel Skinner. They're all with the UIS School of Politics and International Affairs. Thanks once again, and thanks to everybody who tuned in today. Molly, we'll go back to you.
Thank you, Sean, for moderating such a wonderful discussion. And to you, audience, for your time and attention, please ensure that you watch out for future webinars for us and share our distribution list so then you and others can tune in to other great topics in the future.
Thank you to Executive Director Molly Lamb of the UIS Center for State Policy and Leadership, along with our partners, the UIS School of Policy and International Affairs. NPR Illinois is proud to be able to get information like this to you. And thanks to our panelists, Dr. Adriana Crocker, Dr. Ali Nizamuddin, Dr. Brandon Bolte, Dr. Isabel Skinner, and Sean Crawford. What does the Community Voices process look like? Well, it starts with trying to identify a good neighbor to talk to or an event that may be interesting that for some folks it may be hard to get to. First, we get that on the radar, figure out when that is going to happen if there is a date involved with it. But more than anything, we depend on you to suggest a guest. By emailing communityvoices@mprillinois.org, we then go into a process of getting in contact with that person, figuring out if there's enough there, which there usually is, to talk about to help us get to know a little bit more about them or what they're working on or an event that's coming up. We have them come into the studios here at MPR Illinois and do an interview. That interview then gets edited and scheduled to air. It eventually comes on the air and then also gets posted at nprillinois.org, where we share it on social media and encourage our guests and you to do so too. If you missed a past Community Voices, go to nprillinois.org right now. And thanks for being part of Community Voices. Community Voices has brought over 3,000 segments to you in our first 5 years. That's a lot of neighbors, organizations, and events to get to know. But there's nearly a 500,000 people in Central Illinois, so there's a long way to go. Help us. Suggest a guest. Email communityvoices@nprillinois.org. Get to know all of our neighbors with Community Voices, weekdays at noon and 10 p.m.